Case number 53067, Kamaladeen, is that how you pronounce that?
Kamaladeen
versus State. Ms. Bond, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. McCarthy, on behalf of the respondent. Ms. Bond, we're ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you want to reserve some time?
Yes, I would like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
Okay. And thank you for your patience, both of you. We appreciate that.
Certainly, Your Honor. Good morning, honorable members of this court, counsel. My name is Cheryl Bond. I'm with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Muhammad Kamaladeen in this matter, the appellant. At the trial in this case, a question arose as to the fact that Mr. Jonathan Blaisdell, a witness in the case, had been represented by the Public Defender's Office. In the course of, actually at the very beginning of her cross-examination of Mr. Blaisdell, defense counsel asked about his representation in his most immediate prior felony case, and Mr. Blaisdell said that he had been represented by the Public Defender. At a subsequent hearing out of the presence of the jury, this was characterized as a former representation of Mr. Blaisdell. In actuality, district court records show, and we'd ask this court to take judicial notice of, the fact that Mr. Blaisdell had at least four prior felony cases, all of which he'd been represented by the public defender on. In addition, in Mr. Blaisdell's testimony, he indicated that, on direct examination, that he was still incarcerated on the charge for which we had most recently represented him. And under NRS 260.050, our representation continues until the sentence has been fully discharged, including parole, violation, revocation hearings. So we had a current representation of him in at least the most recent case and former representations in at least three other felony cases. Either way, whether he was a former client or a current client, the cross-examination of Mr. Blaisdell was a continuing conflict for Ms. Pusich at the trial below. It was made evident on the record in this case because as she began her cross-examination, she began with, I believe it's three questions about his former representation to establish that it was indeed the public defender's office who'd represented him. She only asked 9 additional questions and then concluded with a comment to the court that she needed to make a record outside the presence of the jury. At that hearing, which was shortly thereafter, defense counsel made it very, very clear that she had not personally represented Mr. Blaisdell, that she had not reviewed any records from our office about Mr. Blaisdell, and that she'd used no confidential communication that our office had gained or any information gained in the representation of Mr. Blaisdell. So it was very clear she had not violated any of her duties to Mr. Blaisdell. Unfortunately, what wasn't covered was her duties to Mr. Kamaladeen.
You're going to have to, of course, establish for us how that conflict, assuming we find it to be a conflict, actually affected the performance as opposed to something that is merely theoretical. I'd like you to address that. And I'd also like you to address what I believe is a further part of the standard required for you to meet, and that is that you must demonstrate that some plausible alternative defense strategy or tactic might have been pursued but was not because of the conflict.
I think the very fact that you're asking me to establish for the court what the actual conflict was really illustrates the essence of the conflict. Essentially, it puts me on the horns of a dilemma. Do I throw my client, Mr. Kamaladeen, under the bus and say my colleague, and by extension my office and myself, did what we should have done? There was no actual conflict we can point to, and therefore Mr. Kamaladeen does not get the zealous representation that he should get? Or do I throw my colleague under the bus, and by extension my office and myself, in order to point to conflicts that defense counsel should have noticed below or should have a performance that of hers that was deficient? It's the similar sort of conflict that it's actually shown in the record here. It's very clear during her cross-examination of Mr. Blaisdell that her focus is on whether she is violating any loyalty or duty owed to Mr. Blaisdell. It's also clear when she talks to the court about it afterward that what issues owed to Mr. Kamaladeen is not foremost in her mind. It's a concern on, have I violated some confidence or a loyalty or a duty to Mr. Blaisdell? It's illustrated by the very last question that the district attorney asks Mr. Blaisdell on direct examination. Mr. Hahn asked, did my office make you any type of promises or cut any kind of deals with you for your testimony today? And Mr. Blaisdell says, no, sir. That's the very last question for direct examination. That's a specific example of something that is a field ripe for cross-examination. While there was apparently, presumably, it's not in our record here, but presumably no formal written agreement, because the prosecutor asked and the witness says, no, we had no agreement for a benefit to me, That's a field that's very ripe for cross-examination on, did you perceive a benefit? Do you still think you might get a benefit? He was still, after all, in prison and facing potentially parole. Is that an area that you and your counsel determined could be of benefit to you? Did your counsel raise it at sentencing in your hearing that you were cooperating with the state in this serious, it was a murder case that he was cooperating on? He was a, relatively speaking, low-level thief, obtaining money by false pretenses, possession of stolen motor vehicles.
Ms. Bond, let me ask you this, and I understand all the points you're making. What is our standard of review to review Judge Flanagan's decision not to disqualify the Washoe County Public Defender's Office?
Of his decision or the standard for conflict?
The standard for his decision. Because we're reviewing his decision.
Right, okay. Right. Well, I just wasn't sure if you were, what right. question you were asking me. I think under the Ryan case, you would be looking at whether he abused his discretion in determining that he found no conflict. Right after Ms. Pusich made her statement about what she did and didn't use in cross-examination, the court then made its statement. And the court's statement was that, and I do have it. Was that obviously a conflict may have been raised if the attorney has access to confidential communication, you may use it and does use it to the detriment of his or her client. Again, focused on Mr. Blaisdell, did you use something you shouldn't have in cross-examining him? It doesn't appear that that occurred in this case. And then the court goes on to conclude that the testimony of Mr. Blaisdell related to a peripheral matter with regard to waxing the car. Actually, it wasn't a peripheral matter. It was about washing the car out. It was the state's explanation, essentially, for why there was no trace evidence from the body of Ms. Calder being in the back of the van. No trace evidence was found in the van, and testimony was included at trial as to that matter. And this washing out of the car with the power washing and the fact that Mr. Kamaladeen's son made sure that all of the hinges and the door jams were power washed in the back of the van and made sure that the mat was taken out and it was power washed under that were the explanation for why there was no trace evidence of hair or blood or tissue in the back of the van. So it wasn't a peripheral witness, and it still doesn't address, the court's only comment is that I don't find a conflict arose to the extent that it requires a disqualification of the defense. I don't think that's an appropriate exercise of discretion regarding the standard of whether there was a conflict and whether the defendant needed to waive the conflict.
Counsel, you also raise an issue about the autopsy photos, and in light of your time, I'm wondering if you might want to get to that issue.
All right, thank you. Yes, I did want to raise an issue on the autopsy photos. The rule, of course, in whether the photographs of a decedent in a murder case can be admitted is whether the relevance of the photographs is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. If that rule has any meaning at all regarding photographs of a decedent in a murder case, if it represents any kind of a limit, this is the case where that limit was exceeded. The relevance of those photographs was extremely minimal. They're photographs of the decedent, so there is some relevance to the murder case, and of course, they're photographs after her death. But the doctor herself, the pathologist herself, had trouble sometimes orienting the photographs or finding the wounds on the photographs. Her testimony was very simple. There were at least 4 stab wounds, at least one of those went through the heart and the aorta, and that killed the decedent. There wasn't a question of, was it a knife or an ice pick? Was it a right hand or a left hand stab? Was it from above or below or an angle? There was no question of that. It was simply that the victim was stabbed a minimum of 4 times. At least one of those went to her heart, and that's what killed her.
But part of the crime was that after the stabbing, that the victim was driven from Reno to a highway between Wells and Jackpot, which is a long, having driven that road, I know that's over 300 miles, and there's nothing on that road between Wells and Jackpot. It's all desert, and the body was dumped out in the middle of the desert. So the fact there were animal insect bites and animal things, isn't that a byproduct of the jury concluding your client was responsible for this murder? So it's just unfortunate, but that's part of the case. And
actually, what the doctor testified to is that is the natural effect of decomposition. It had nothing to do with the cause of death, that the body, which was described various ways, blackish, greenish, grayish, massively decomposed to the point where she couldn't even determine if there were wounds to her neck because there was so much insect activity and so much decomposition, that's a natural part of essentially the death process or the process after death of the decomposition of the body. There wasn't a question of those photographs showing that this is what occurred to her because she was left in the desert, or that this was somehow important to the proof that Mr. Kamaluddin was responsible for her death. The photographs were used solely, theoretically, for the purpose of showing and illustrating Dr. Raven's testimony about the autopsy and the stab wounds. The problem is, and that gives the photographs their minimal relevance, the problem is the danger of unfair prejudice. And in this case, the photographs were beyond just gruesome. They were beyond what we would typically think of as a photograph in an autopsy or photograph of a decedent. I put the Hearst song in my brief not to be flip, but because that's what kept playing through my mind, because I didn't want, as I looked at it, and I think common prevailing standards in the U.S. would be, we don't want to think about the fact that this is how we're going to look someday. Absent the maggots if we're in...
How did Judge Flanagan handle the situation? How did the judge handle the situation as far as the photos? I know I used to do it as a trial judge, and I'm sure that both of these, my colleagues, had their way to do it. How did he do it? And did he exclude any?
There was a hearing prior to the trial, and he had one photograph redacted, and I don't believe he excluded any of the others. What he redacted was a head and neck portion of one photograph. But he concluded that, and I wrote his standard down, that if there was some probative value and some meaningful evidentiary purpose, that this court has said gruesome photos come in even if they're gruesome, grisly, or inflammatory, as long as there's some meaningful evidentiary purpose and some probative value. Of course, that's not the standard. So he didn't follow the appropriate standard when he admitted the photographs to begin with. And I see I have 4 minutes left, so I'd like to
reserve the right. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. McCarthy, on behalf of the state.
Good afternoon, members of the court. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County. I also want to talk about the so-called conflict issue, probably for different reasons, but this comes up a lot. In fact, as we speak, there's litigation going on about a private attorney who found out he has previously represented a witness in a trial that's supposed to start next week. This comes up constantly. We need some guidance from this court. Actually disposing of the case is relatively simple. I mean, even if there's an actual conflict of interest, which there isn't, even with an actual conflict of interest, you have to show some effect on the representation, and there wasn't any. The suggestion that maybe there was, maybe there wasn't, that's not the same as saying there was. You can't identify any effect on the representation.
So, frankly, you're responding to my question. Even if we were to find the conflict, the fact of the matter is it did not affect the representation in this case such that we need to be concerned about.
I'm answering that and saying that's so actually disposing of this case, that issue in this case, is relatively simple. I hope you don't do that. I hope you don't rest on that, because this is a recurring problem. I see three ethical rules here possibly at play. And none of them would go so far as to say you can never cross-examine a former client. There are limitations, of course. But the only one that's relevant is you can't use information from the prior representation to the disadvantage of the former client. Well, he's a witness. He's not a party to the action. He's not going to be advantaged or disadvantaged. But the other is you can't use confidential information at all without the consent. And again, this applying that is relatively easy in this case because, Ms. Pusic said, I have no dirt. I got nothing to use here, nothing to hold back. But still, we need a little bit of guidance for other cases. And it can be difficult. It'll make a lawyer think a little bit before he asks questions. And I agree with that. I've been a public defender. I've been a private lawyer. And I've got to tell you, I'm not comfortable with the concept of cross-examining my former clients. But there's no absolute rule that says you can't do it. And that's the way we've treated it, at least in Washoe County. We've treated it as an absolute rule, saying, somebody in your office once represented this car wash attendant. All right, well, you're gone. We'll call a mistrial, send this jury home, and then we'll try and see if the alternate public defender has ever represented this person. And then we'll try private counsel. Maybe on the fourth or fifth lawyer, we'll find some kid fresh out of school that has never represented this guy. That's not the rule, and it ought not to be. And I'd ask the court to go through the ethics rules that apply. Give us a little guidance. Tell the courts of Washoe County and of the other counties, too, you don't have to automatically disqualify the public defender's office simply because somebody in that office once represented a witness. There are limits on what that lawyer can do. Can't use confidential information. You can use information he gets from other sources. There's a suggestion in the reply brief that private counsel, some other lawyer, could have interviewed this car wash attendant, but that Ms. Pusic somehow couldn't interview him. I don't see why not. You know, if you want to interview a witness, go ahead. So in addition to the easy disposition of this case, I'd ask the court to give us a little guidance here. If we've been doing it wrong, I wish the court would say so. If we've been doing it right, we're going to have to go back to county commissioners and get some more money. Moving to the photos, there was, in the last few years, we're missing a word. In the cases from this court of the last several years, we're missing the word unfair. That's what the statute governing the evidence says. Compare the risk of unfair prejudice, not just prejudice, unfair prejudice. That is the risk that it's going to be misused by the jury. I suggest in this case there is absolutely no risk of misusing this evidence. What it demonstrates is that about 10 days earlier, some days earlier, somebody had stabbed this woman to death. That's what it was offered to prove. There is no unfair prejudice stemming from that.
It also puts us in the position of trying to second guess some trial judge who's looking at the pictures, knows the facts of the case, does the trial, and then we're supposed to second guess as to whether that picture caused a problem, a due process violation to a defendant. And that makes us puts us in a real bad position. If we start second guessing all the pictures, we'll never get any cases resolved here.
It's probably more like a third guess, because in this case you had two experienced trial lawyers got together and they said, they came in with their whole stack of photos and said, yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes.
So there was more to it than just the judge, in fact.
Yeah, there's two of them. Originally there was three that, for which there was a dispute, and then the state agreed and said, well, let's crap that one. And so there's only two photographs. One of them, the objection was it shows insect activity. And the medical examiner testified, I use this insect activity that you can see here in photo number 4 or whatever it was to confirm the testimony of the eyewitness about when this person was murdered. And the other one shows a defect in the clothing lining up with the wound on the body. And the medical examiner says, see, she was wearing clothes when she was stabbed to death, just like the eyewitness said. So there's nothing wrong with that. Even if it was a de novo review, you ought to affirm, but it isn't.
It's the fact that the body was dumped in the desert over 300 miles from Reno, there's a picture showing where the body was located in the desert. Is that relevant for that reason?
You know, I'll confess to you, I haven't looked at the photographs. I assume there is some geography revealed in the photographs.
I kind of gathered that from reading the materials, but of course we haven't seen the pictures either. So.
Yeah, there's... The two that I saw a dispute about, I don't know if they have any geography in there. There is a testimony about what is in the pictures relating it to the time of death, saying that this insect activity is consistent with the testimony of the eyewitness to the murder about when it occurred. So you kill somebody and leave the body laying out there for some period of days, and this is what you get. You get these bugs. It was each photograph was used and explained, and each of them was relevant, tended to establish or corroborate the testimony of the medical examiner. Is that related to the testimony of the eyewitness to the murder? So even if it was a de novo review, I'd say there's no error here. Because it's discretionary, it's certainly not an abuse of discretion. It's abuse of discretion should be something more than this court disagrees later. It should be, you know, where the record reveals that the court flipped a coin, you know, arbitrary. That phrase is used more in civil cases than criminal, but arbitrary and whimsical decisions. And this is clearly not arbitrary or whimsical. The judge looked at it and heard the testimony and decided that the jury could hear it too. And
I've heard of arbitrary and capricious. I'm not sure her arbitrary and whimsical, you know.
Well, that's pretty
so that's one of the terms that like
that. I always like that one,
you know. Okay.
But it implies something along the lines of flipping a coin. Mm-hmm. And when the record reveals that the court conscientiously determined, you know, that applying the correct standards, that the evidence should come in, it shouldn't be reversed. And there is no problem with the standard that the court used. And if there was a problem at all, it's that the court, like so many others, forgot to talk about unfair prejudice. So when we throw that in, the result is much more clear.
I want to go back to the conflict-free situation. Let me just give you a little background. When I first became a public defender in 1970, we used to represent co-defendants.
Yeah.
And in fact, my first trial, I had five defendants. I pled four of them guilty and took the fifth one to trial, and he got found not guilty, so I became a superstar. But then when I became assistant public defender between 74 and 78, I came up with the rule, and I take credit for this throughout the state, that we should not represent co-defendants anymore.
Right.
And then we were able to establish the contract attorneys. So I need to know what holding you would have, because I think my colleagues would admit that, at least in Clark County, when the public defender comes forward and says, we have a conflict, that's it. I mean, they really don't go into real detail about it, because we have the, in murder cases, we have the alternate public defender, a special public defender, and we have 30-some-odd contract attorneys.
Right.
So what holding would you want us to make? And I'm going to ask public defender the same thing. What would be the holding as far as conflict-free representation?
A little bit more than the PD's conclusion that I won, or somebody in my office once represented a witness in this action. It's something more than that.
So you want us to go almost on the Batson third prong, where we make a factual determination of what constitutes the actual conflict?
I would suggest an inquiry. And just step in the chambers. It's none of the prosecutor's business. And find out. You have a limit on your ability to successfully, you know, or effectively cross-examine this witness. Does anybody care who this witness is or what this witness has to say? You know, find an actual problem. The theoretical problem is not enough to justify moving to the alternate public defender and then to private counsel. It's in most cases, it's not a problem at all.
You don't think that the Hubby case out of our Ninth Circuit addresses that? That's the quote that I used earlier, where I said that you must demonstrate that some plausible alternative defense strategy or tactic might have been pursued, but was not.
U.S. Supreme Court hasn't added that phrase about some alternative defense strategy. They have required to show once an actual conflict is demonstrated, the U.S. Supreme Court has required demonstration of some effect on the representation. Geez, if the Ninth Circuit wants to make it a little bit easier on the prosecutor, I'll alert the media because it never happened before. So, I'm sorry, did I say that out loud?
I said.
And I don't recommend that standard. I recommend going with the standard announced by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I tend to think that they're more right than the Ninth Circuit more often. So anyway, and it's not necessary. There's been no demonstration of any actual conflict and no demonstration of any effect. So that part is kind of easy. There was a third issue raised in here, and that's about sentencing. And as I looked at the brief last night, I realized there's no mention at all of Mendoza-Lobos, a fairly recent decision involving weapons enhancements. And I want to take this opportunity to mention.
Was there an objection by the defendant regarding the sentencing procedure?
No. There was some disputed evidence about uncharged misconduct in Canada, and Judge Flanagan said, all right, well, I won't consider it then. So he gave the defense whatever they asked for at sentencing, except for the sentence that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
In Mendoza-Lobos, this court first said that the statute requiring the district judge to make some comments regarding the weapons enhancement is unconstitutional. It intrudes on the prerogative of the court, and then said, but we're going to do it on our own. We're going to impose such a requirement. And then, having said that, the court then inquired into the legislative intent. for the statute that you said you weren't going to apply. So I found that a little bit odd, and I'd ask the court to reconsider that and treat the weapons enhancement more like the habitual criminal enhancement and ask if the record as a whole reveals that the judge entered the sentence in ignorance, or if the judge clearly knew that the term of the enhancement was discretionary. In this case, it's clear that it was discretionary. For one, it wasn't automatically doubled. So that's pretty good clear indication.
I guess the issue, he ran the solicitation consecutive to the murder and the enhancement, so that's probably the discretionary part. I guess he could have run that concurrent.
I think there's a weapon involved, too. There's also an elder enhancement, and that one merged with the weapons enhancement, if I recall right. In any event, I don't perceive any prejudicial error at sentencing, so the whole smear ought to be affirmed.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ms. Bond? You have 3 minutes and 52 seconds, and you can start by answering my question as to what holding would the Warsaw public defender like us to make as far as this conflict issue.
Thank you. It's interesting to me that Mr. McCarthy would want some judicial involvement. The PD's office and the DA's office in Washoe County have conferred with one another, and their civil division says we have the right standard. Now, if he means if this occurs at trial as opposed to before trial, if we try to get judicial involvement prior to trial and whether we have a conflict in every case we conflict out or not, justice is going to grind to a halt. There are too many cases coming in every day where we have conflicts and it has to be sent to the alternate public defender, and then what they do is none of my business. If he's talking about specifically a case like this one, where it occurs at trial or at a hearing, what I would suggest this court do, if you're going to establish a bright line rule, I would think an administrative ADKT type hearing where all the involved agencies could give input would be a more appropriate vehicle. If you want to establish it here, the only rule that won't allow some conflicts to occur inappropriately and deprive some people of their right to conflict-free representation would be exactly what Mr. McCarthy doesn't want. And that is, if you have a client or former client who is a witness in a criminal case, you cannot represent the defendant in that criminal case unless both parties, with the appropriate Ryan standards met, independent counsel, waive the conflict, both the client parties, the witness and the defendant. I don't think that's necessary. I don't think the court needs to make a bright-line rule. I think what should have been done in this case is the instant those initial three questions were asked and it was stated by the witness, Mr. Blaisdell, that he had been represented by the public defender, trial should come to a halt at that moment, and defense counsel would have an obligation, I think, at that point to go and look at what prior representation there was, to discover how many times you've represented him, is there anything still active. At that point, the court should have had an in-camera hearing with defense counsel. Is there or is there not a conflict? There may be cases where there is no conflict, trial could resume. If there is, then the court could either appoint independent counsel to both Mr. Blaisdell and Mr. Kamaluddin, and if they waive after appropriate consultation with independent counsel, if they waive a conflict, they could move forward. And if not, then trial would have to start over with conflict-free counsel. That really is a procedure that should be followed. It should not be a procedure where everyone just ignores it. And something I wanted to point out is that there was an effect on representation. That's in the record. It's very clear in the record that defense counsel's focus at the point she learns Mr. Blaisdell was represented by her office previously is not to violate Mr. Blaisdell's rights and not to violate any confidentiality with him. And this is the divided loyalty that prejudiced Mr. Kamaluddin, because she did not treat Mr. Blaisdell as a witness she'd never contacted before or never represented before. She treated him with kid gloves as, I don't even want to know. I'm not going to look at our file. And in fact, she says later, I didn't have any information and I don't have any information. Apparently, she doesn't make it very clear in the record, but apparently she doesn't go to look back at public defender records prior to that hearing. I'm not even sure she had time. I think it was immediately after to look at those records to see if there was a conflict or was some other information she could have used. Defense counsel also cannot go to a prior witness because of the rules in Ryan, a prior client, and say, you're now a witness in one of my other client's cases. Are you okay with me asking you questions that may delve into our confidential communications? She can't do that. He's got to have independent counsel to make that decision and to make that waiver. So she can't treat him just like any other witness. I did want to move on to the photographs. Mr. McCarthy points out that the key focus here is unfair prejudice, and that's exactly right. It strains the realms of fiction to imagine that a jury would look at these photographs and view them clinically and ignore the maggots and the damage from the insects. The court does have the pictures. I move that they be sent to the court. That motion was granted, and I confirmed with Mario Lopez in the Second Judicial District Court that those photographs were sent here, so the court can view them personally. At no point in her testimony does Dr. Raven say, This part of the photograph in the insect activity proves that 17 days prior to her finding, this is when she was killed. Instead, she says simply, the insect activity that I viewed is consistent with the timeline that the district attorney was presenting. So the photographs were not necessary at that point for that purpose. And additionally, as the court will see, they don't reveal any particular geography to establish where she was found, the ones that were used at trial. And unless the court has any questions.
Questions? Just give us. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Bond.
Thank you.
Ms. McCarthy, thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. Excellent arguments. Good briefs. And this case will stand submitted. And